listening to the only daily talk show in North America covering the world of football. This is World Football Daily.
Yes! It hits the back of the net! Oh my goodness me!
The world's game.
Oh, you're beautiful! What a headshot! What a head!
Our religion.
Brilliant goal! What an equalizer!
Our passion.
Go, go, USA! Oh, it's incredible! You could not write a script like this!
World Football Daily serves up the best football talk 5 days a week.
Oh! You will never, ever see a game quite like this! Unbelievable!
Hola, buenos dias, and welcome to a Latino football special here on World Football Daily. That's right, we are heading south of the border down Mexico way. We are going to Mexico. We are going to South America. And we are talking all things World Cup qualification on the show today. It's the last show before we get to the big, big games tomorrow. All across the world, teams are still vying for their places. At Brazil 2014 next summer, we're going to give you the lowdown on who will be and who won't be joining them and what has to take place for sides to get into the big show. Joining me, as always, on the show will be, of course, Mr. Rafa Gonzalez. Isn't it great that our producer is Rafa? You know, already giving us that South American Latin flair for the show today. But I'm also going to be joined by two experts of Central and South American football. That's right, joining us later on, Mr. Rupert Fryer will be talking all things South American football. Rupert, of course, a lead writer for ESPN, The Football Ramble, The Observer, The Guardian, and the co-founder of southamericanfootball.co.uk. You can find him at Rupert Fryer, capital R and capital F. But coming up, and actually on the line now waiting for us, she is a lady who knows all things Mexican football. I guess we have Jackie Oatley, the queen of football. We have, of course, Rebecca Lowe on the show. She is, of course, now the first lady of football. So I guess the lady joining me now is La Reina del Fútbol. Of course, it is Miss Kim Tate, Mexican football expert, joining us here on World Football Daily to talk all things El Tri and their chances of making it to next summer's big show. Kim, it's a pleasure to have you on today. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure as always. Now, first and foremost, we like to kind of introduce any new guests on World Football Daily we have to the audience. So tell us a little bit about yourself, about what has drawn you to Mexican football in general?
Well, I've always been interested in the Mexican sport. I was, you know, to go into a personal side of things, I was raised in a single parent household. My mom worked three jobs just to put food on the table. And, you know, a majority of my time was spent at my best friend's house with her Mexican family. So, you know, I've always felt very comfortable around the Mexican culture. As I got older, I became more interested in the Mexican culture, and I've always loved football, or soccer as we call it here in America. So, you know, just recently over the last years, I've been covering it a little more intimately in trying to decide on a direction for myself as a professional. I figured that, you know, Mexico just kind of fit. There's not really a lot of American broadcasters, not a ton of American journalists covering the sport as substantively as I feel that it deserves. So I figured, why not give it a shot? It's been really enjoyable. I went to my first Mexico game in the Gold Cup against Panama here in California at the Rose Bowl in July. And just before that, I'd seen my first Cholos versus Club America game at Petco Park. It was a friendly, but nonetheless, it was a good time. So here I am.
I'm sure there are plenty of people that are extremely jealous about your trips already into Liga MX and, of course, the trip to the Gold Cup as well. Before we get into Mexico and their chance of getting to Brazil 2014, we were discussing a little earlier on the show, Kim, about the idea of Janusaj joining and pledging his future to English football. Now, in US soccer, the US men's national team has had a number of players that maybe haven't even been born in the US, aren't too affiliated to the US despite their eligibility to play for the country. When you're watching the US men's national team, if there's a number of players in the same position as Janusaj who are playing for the US men's national team, do you find it detracts slightly from being kind of drawn to the US men's national team as a fan?
No, I mean, when you're talking about the U.S. national team, this is a really tricky subject. This is one that's stirred a lot of debate. You know, I know historically it's been possible for players to play for different national teams, even if they weren't born or even if they hadn't lived in that country for a substantial period of time. You know, I can name a ton of players who have played for, you know, their birth country and then have gone on 3 or 4 years later to play for a country where they never even lived. And, you know, I don't know that this is an exact quote, so don't quote me 100% on this, but
sure.
I recall Jurgen Klinsmann saying something like, you know, America is, you know, a melting pot of cultures, and that's sort of what this team has become. But, you know, speaking to the point that Jack Wilshere was trying to make, I don't really think that a lot of our players, you know, were born in other countries and then came to America, only lived here for 3 or 4 years, and all of a sudden they're playing for us. You know, I think that there's more of a deep-rooted nationality to the United States for the U.S. men's national team than in this particular situation. As a fan, it doesn't really affect whether or not I root 100% for the national team. It doesn't really affect my criticism of them. If I'm going to criticize the national team, it's going to be for something completely different. I'm not really too worried about that. But, you know, back to the point with eligibility and nationality and all that, I know that in 2004, FIFA had kind of made a change and said, okay, well, you know, we're going to set forth a new set of rules that are a little bit more stringent and, you know, set additional requirements that are going to determine which country a player can represent. And I think to some extent you have to have some restrictions. You know, to quote Sepp Blatter.
Oh, yes, a fantastic man to quote here, Kim. Yeah.
Everybody's favorite executive in football. In 2007 or 2008, I think, you know, he told the BBC, if we don't stop this, you know, players just who were born in one country and have, you know, dual nationalities in another, and they just want to, you know, jump toward another country because they want to represent that country, then by the time we reach the 2014 or 2018 World Cups, out of the 32 teams, you're going to have 16 full of Brazilian players, you know, and it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. So, like I said, it's kind of a touchy subject, but I can see where Jack Wilshere is coming from, definitely. I mean, there are a lot of guys who are English who are competing for a spot on that squad, and to have someone who isn't English come in, especially if what he did for Manchester United last week continues on, you know, it's probably looked at as unfair. But then again, you know, it's not really a new concept to national team eligibility. So
I wonder if Jack's just a little worried about maybe losing his place already in the England side. We'll have to wait and see how that issue goes as we continue to wait and see if Janusaj will pledge his future to England, and of course won't be eligible for another few years just yet. Maybe Jack's just getting a little worried though. Kim, let's get on to a little bit of Mexican football and talk about this Mexican national side that really are in a vital stage, taking on Panama this weekend. Has to be a win, surely. You know, this is do or die time for the Mexican national side. They've changed managers in the last month or so. Obviously, Chepo de la Torre out. Is it too little too late for Mexico, Kim?
I don't think it's too little too late. I do think that they're going to qualify, but they're going to do it in dramatic fashion. I think Alexi Lawless summed it up really well recently in saying, you know, Mexico just doesn't put the fear in God into anybody when they're playing anymore, and certainly not in CONCACAF right now, and he's right. You know, gone are the days when teams actually feared playing Mexico. I mean, they're a mess. I think psychologically, you know, whatever went on with that team under Chepo de la Torre, there was no team chemistry. What was once a team of cohesion is now at times looking like they have no idea what to do with the ball. So having Vucetich come in, you know, he's made a lot of changes already. ahead of the World Cup qualifiers. He held camps Monday through Wednesday where he called in a bunch of different players just to kind of see, who really gelled, who had the potential to maybe win a starting role that hadn't been present before. He's certainly decorated. He's won 13 of 14 finals. He's won two Segunda División titles in Mexico. He's done, great historically in CONCACAF, and now his World Cup qualifying selections, kind of speak to his experience, I guess. He's called in a lot of guys from Tigres in Monterrey, where he was a coach for so long, Leon, calling back in Rafa Márquez for that real strong veteran leadership and experience. I already like the changes that he's made in comparison with Chepo. So, like I said, I think they can get the job done, but, they've got their work cut out for them. They need to score a lot of goals against Panama. They've won one game in 8 matches, 2 losses, drawn 5, but, they failed to win at home in this qualification, which is huge. And they've lost to Panama already twice this year. So they've got, like I said, they've got their work cut out for them, especially against Panama, but I think they can do it.
Is that going to prey on this Mexican side kind of mentality going into this game, though? The fact that what was such a fortress, the Azteca, has been broken so dramatically over the last few months. That's got to be a big mental challenge for them.
Yeah, it is a big mental challenge, isn't it? And hopefully Vucetich can sort of reinstill that confidence into his players. And hopefully they can go into it with confidence. I mean, a win at the Azteca against Panama, scoring 2, 3, 4 goals would be really nice, wouldn't it? It'd be a great confidence booster for them.
It would. It would surely settle the camp. You mentioned Rafa Márquez coming back in and the important role that he can play as an experienced leader. Obviously, as well, Guillermo Ochoa coming back into it as well. But no room, surprisingly, for Carlos Vela, who was many expected to see coming back. Are you surprised by the selection of Vucetich, to not bring back Carlos Vela into this El Tri side?
Carlos Vela, it's unfortunate to see this type of saga. It's so dramatic. The way that it's played out has been really interesting because the national team could definitely use him. And I think all Mexico fans out there will agree with me that, to have Vela, Dos Santos, and an informed Chicha out there with an option like an Oribe Peralta on the bench, it's a dream. But unfortunately, it's not going to play out that way. And, this whole thing with Vela has gone back 2 years at least to 2011, where he had a feud with Chepo. Vucetich did actually call him in when he called up Memo Ochoa, and both accepted the call-in. There was a positive response there from both players, and that was really nice to see because, people had been protesting, why isn't Chepo calling in Vela? And then also to see, Memo Ochoa finally agree to a call-up. You'd think that, the common denominator there was Chepo. There's reports flying around that, Vela recently told Hector Inarritu, who's the director of national team selections, that he wasn't ready to represent El Tri because he's not fit. So that seemed a little bit odd. But then when you dig back, you look at other excuses we've heard from him, like he didn't want to come in because he's not getting along with other players, or he's having problems with the FMF, the Mexican Football Federation. He's even tossed around claims that he was unfairly treated by El Tri on past appearances. So, you can blame, I know people have blamed Chepo, but when you start to look at all of Vela's excuses, you almost wonder if there's a little bit more than what meets the eye. I mean, he's performing well for Real Sociedad in La Liga. He recently scored in UCL. He had 12 goals out of 35 appearances in his first season for Real Sociedad, 14 the following season in 35 games. He spent time in EPL at Arsenal, so it's really unfortunate to see a talent like Vela, not be utilized by the Mexican national team. I know that Vucetich did want him in there, but at this point it's kind of like, we've given you every opportunity to, get over it and have the chance to come back, and you know, if you're not going to take it, then unfortunately, you know, maybe that ship has sailed for Carlos Vela. You know, there's a possibility that we may not see him come back, which is really unfortunate. But I think that, you know, we've got some pretty good options up front. You know, we've got Chicharito Hernandez, you know, Oribe Peralta, who's been in great form this season. He was great in the Olympics as well, you know, so he's got some good players that can take his place, but to not have him in the squad is definitely disappointing.
We do, as you say, have Javier Hernandez and Giovanni Dos Santos as well. A lot relying on both these two players. Dos Santos finally getting some regular first team football, but Hernandez has been out of the United side for the majority of the start of this season under David Moyes and has been struggling for play in general at the Red Devils. Do you think that's had a hindrance on his appearances for the national team? The fact that Hernandez hasn't ingrained himself as a first 11 player at Manchester United consistently?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it definitely has an effect on his performance. I mean, but the thing is, you know, he's Mexico's top striker, you know, who's out there playing internationally right now. The fact that, you know, in the last three starts that he's had for Manchester United, he's scored in every single one of those. I mean, he's got three goals in as many starts. That's promising. You know, we saw what he did when he started in that, I think it was a Champions League game. He scored a great goal. You know, it's great to know that he's still got it, but at the same time, yeah, you definitely want a striker and, you know, the guy that you depend on to score a majority of your goals. You want him to be getting playing time with his club. And, you know, right now, for me, Oribe Peralta with Santos Laguna is ahead of him. You know, the real trick is going to be whether or not, seeing whether or not Vucetich is able to get Peralta and Chicha playing together, because, you know, historically they've never really had that chemistry together. You know, individually they can both score goals all day long, but, you know, together they haven't really had that chemistry. Going back to Chicha's situation at Manchester United, you know, he was recently quoted saying, you know, he's going on 4 years there. You know, he said, I'm really happy to be able to play for one of the best clubs in the world. I'm doing my best every single day to earn more minutes on the pitch. You know, having to compete with players like Robin Van Persie and Wayne Rooney only makes me a better player. And there's some truth to that. But I think that, you know, David Moyes has made it pretty clear that Chicha is, you know, his maybe third option for striker at best. Some would even argue that maybe he's his fourth choice. So
Hernandez behind Danny Welbeck at Manchester United. I never thought I'd see that, because I'm a big fan of Hernandez and his striking ability in front of goal. Finally, Kim, we can't let you go without giving us a prediction on your opening appearance here on World Football Daily. We've got the Panama game coming up on Saturday night, UK time, of course, Friday evening out on your side of the globe. And, of course, the game against Costa Rica. But we'll just leave it for the Panama game for now. Mexico in the Azteca against Panama. What's it going to be, Kim?
I'm going to predict a 2-1 score in favor of Mexico. I think that Vucetic will get their confidence up. You know, it's definitely difficult to play at Azteca, and I think there's a lot weighing on this game, so the environment is going to be especially hostile. You know, I think some of the changes I think we'll definitely see some changes in tactics. It'll be helpful to have Rafa Marquez back if he starts. That would be great because, you know, with his experience at Barcelona, he can kind of build an attack out of the back. You know, I think we're going to see a different Mexico squad, and I'm confident that they can pull out at least two goals. I'm going 2-1 Mexico.
Wow, that got more and more confident as you went there with that last answer. I definitely think you're growing in confidence as we get towards that big Panama game, but we'll have to wait until tomorrow night for that. Kim, thank you so much for joining us here on World Football Daily. We appreciate you taking the time out. We will let you get back to, I'm sure, your busy desk, planning and preparing your coverage of L3. And their big games coming up in World Cup qualification, Kim. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Cheers. Kim Tate there joining us here on World Football Daily. Freelance writer talking all things Mexican football. And, of course, Mexico with those big games coming up against Panama and Costa Rica in World Cup qualification. Sat outside of the qualification positions at this moment in time. But it's still a possibility that they will be able to get the job done and make their way to Brazil 2014. The US men's national team are already there. And of course, There's plenty more to be decided. We're going to be going through the whole of Europe in a second, but we do have to talk somewhere that maybe we haven't looked at in a little bit of time. It is, of course, a little bit of South American football. And, of course, there's still plenty to be decided in the South American World Cup qualifiers. We have just the man to talk all things South American football with us. Joining us today on World Football Daily, a man who really should need no introduction because we've had him on the show a number of times now. Joining me to talk all things South American football, an accomplished freelance writer, Mr. Rupert Fryer, joining us here on World Football Daily to chat about everything south of the border. Rupert, it's a pleasure to have you back on World Football Daily, my good man. How excited are you about the start of the South, the finale, if you will, of the South American qualification group?
It's business time.
It is business time, so to speak. We're not almost done here. There's still plenty to be settled in CONMEBOL because Uruguay have had such a rocky qualification process. Are you surprised how much they have struggled with this whole saga across the last 14 games?
Yes and no. Surprised, yes, because obviously probably if you're looking at the World Cup and then the subsequent Copa America, you could probably argue that they were the best side in South America. In fact, I'd categorically say that. I think Brazil and Argentina were both in transition. Colombia were struggling. And yeah, I think Uruguay were certainly the strongest team on the continent. We had an inkling this might happen, really. It was an aging squad, that one that went to the semi-finals of the World Cup and claimed the Copa America. And then there was a lot of emphasis in Uruguay put on the Olympics. The Olympics was supposed to be a big deal. I know it's not necessarily viewed as a huge competition in Europe, but for South America, it's a huge deal. And especially so for Uruguay, it was supposed to be the time in which they could sort of bring all these younger guys through. And, the Olympics was a complete disaster, really. I saw them a couple of times and they were quite awful. So then we kind of knew, they might be in a little bit of trouble. But even so, I didn't necessarily expect them to struggle just as much as they did. I mean, they went, I think six qualifiers or so without a win. So, they were really looking in trouble a few rounds ago.
It was all going very horribly for them, but suddenly form's been picked up again and they have to now go on the road, though, to this vital game against Ecuador in Ecuador, fourth and fifth, battling it out for those automatic spots to Brazil 2014. How difficult is it in South America in general? Give us a picture just to go on the road because of the changes in altitude, the huge distance travelled across the continent for these games.
Yeah, very much so. They're great equaliser, really. And home advantage really is that in South America. Obviously, they're vast distances, as you said, changes in climate. Uruguay will have to go all the way up to Quito, where they might have a few problems. A couple of Uruguayan teams did, I recall, when over those couple of years when LDU were doing so fantastically well in continental competition. So yeah, it's not going to be easy for Uruguay. They know that, but they tend to thrive when their backs are against the wall, Uruguay. They really dig in. It's something of a cliche, but that old sort of Garacharua mentality sort of has really come through, and that's what a lot of the guys have been talking about over the past month or so. Now they're really just trying to keep up with some momentum. I mean, they come to a complete halt, as we know, with that terrible run they had to endure. But yeah, things are going a lot better for them now. They won three games in a row now. Now it's just a case of really heading there and trying to keep that momentum going.
And they play an Ecuador side that really is a side that hasn't maybe caught people by surprise, but is certainly one of the most emphatic Ecuador sides that we've seen in a long time and playing some incredible football. Have you been slightly taken aback by how competent they have looked throughout this qualification process? Or is this maybe something that we've expected with this group of players kind of reaching a peak altogether, if you will?
Yes, perhaps so. I mean, the other thing is not just Ecuador, but the Confederation as a whole. We were pretty much expecting this round to be highly competitive all the way through. We've had a couple of disappointments. I've been particularly disappointed by Peru, in fact. Sergio Macarian came in and did a wonderful job throughout the Copa America, and I was really hoping they would kick on. That hasn't happened. Paraguay were sort of all but done, really, following the Copa America. They got to the final without winning a single game. Tata Martino, he knew their time was up there. He knew where they were finished, and obviously got out while the going was good. So they've really, really, really struggled. A number of the other teams, they knew they were really in with a good chance this round. I mean, I'd probably say this is possibly... In fact, I would say this is the most competitive qualifying campaign that I think the World Cup as a whole has ever seen. when we first arrived, you know, in round one, it was anybody's really. I mean, Bolivia obviously lack a lot of quality, but again, they have the dizzy heights of La Paz, which was such a tremendous equaliser. They've sort of done that thing they traditionally do, where it's just a horrible place to go, and they take points away from the teams who are really vying for those qualification places. I didn't expect Ecuador to compete. They've sort of been up and down. We've had a couple of runs where they've just looked fabulous, and a couple of where perhaps not so much. But they've been great fun also. I mean, not least Jefferson Montero has been wonderful fun to watch. Really, really great player. Well, perhaps not a great player, but terrific fun. I mean, one-on-one, he's incredible. He's just been taking everybody on for fun, running past three or four players. And yeah, it's a bit of a shame that he can't really finish or find that final ball, because if he could, it'd be something special.
For South American qualification, you said that you described it as the most contested, hotly contested qualification the World Cup's ever seen. Why is that? Is that because teams have caught up with the likes of Argentina to an extent? Of course, they have done extremely well and been reasonably dominant in this qualification process. But has South American football improved as a whole? And that makes it one of the stronger kind of federations going into the World Cup, especially down in South America? Or is it more of a case of it is just the kind of the home field advantage, if you will, that is making, as you described earlier, the great leveller?
No, I think that perhaps that does play a part, obviously. If that wasn't the case, again, sort of the likes of Bolivia, I don't think would really be able to compete. Mm. I was saying that they do necessarily sometimes go sort of away and dig in and find some points. But the biggest thing, of course, has been CONMEBOL's move into one big qualifying group. I mean, normally you're only as good as your competition, and it just raised the level of competition for everybody. It gave everybody competitive games. And I mean, if you really want to see a true example of that, you only need to look at Venezuela, who, what, a little over a decade ago were really sort of a San Marino equivalent. But since then, they've come on in leaps and bounds. And again, it looks like they're going to struggle now. They've got a 6-goal swing, I think, to try and make that playoff space. So that's not going to happen. They are just going to narrowly miss out. But to look at how far they've come, and they've put a lot of resources into football ever since they hosted a Copa America. Both sort of monetary and just getting bodies involved. There's been a few things that have happened now. I think Juan Arango had a huge impact. He was perhaps their sort of David Beckham, shall we say. He was their first proper Venezuelan superstar. So they've done fabulously well. It's a bit of a shame, really, for them that they're going to miss out. But I think it's just playing these competitive games constantly, where you're constantly playing against strong competition. And I think it's raised the level overall.
You have to be very careful when discussing Juan Arango here on World Football Daily, because, of course, we don't want people to think that it's Juan Arango from the Mad About Football Boys that's been such a heavy influence on Venezuelan football, of course. Rupert,
we were discussing him just now for a second. I thought, oh, God, have I dropped the wrong name in there?
I tell you what, I mean, who knows? We do not know exactly what he does down there in Miami. He could be pulling the strings of Venezuelan football without us knowing it, Rupert. But no, definitely not Wham from World Football Daily and Goal TV that we're talking about there. You just never know. You never know. Talking of going into this World Cup then, I know we're obviously many months away. It's coming up next summer, of course. But When we went into World Cup 94, there was a lot of talk surrounding sides like Colombia from South America. People were saying that, you know, there were these teams, these up-and-coming teams from South America that had a very slight outside possibility of winning the whole thing. When you look at the South American teams in general that have already qualified, Chile, Colombia, Argentina, and of course it's going to be Ecuador, Uruguay, or Venezuela going into it. Are all of these sides, with it being down in South America, at this moment in time, do you think potential winners of this?
Perhaps not. Colombia have undoubtedly raised their game, and sort of to pick up upon what you were saying earlier about the 1994 World Cup, I mean, Pelé, shall we say, a lot of people kind of make fun of a lot of his predictions, but I think that was one that was right on the money. They thrashed Argentina in Buenos Aires in that qualification campaign, and for my money, they probably did come into that World Cup as possibly the strongest team in the world, certainly the strongest in South America. It's a wonderful team, and obviously lots of things went wrong there, not just necessarily on the pitch, but there's a lot of off-field things that sort of played against them, shall we say, cool, during that campaign. But they're another side who have really, really come on strong throughout this qualification campaign, looking ahead to Brazil. Jose Pekerman's come in and done a brilliant job. I think the key thing he really did, for all the talk of James Rodriguez and Falcao and and the likes of sort of the biggest stars, I think the most important player for my money for Colombia has been McNeely Torres. I mean, when Jose Pekerman came in, he immediately sort of assessed their biggest problem, which was ball retention. They really, really struggled for a player who just put his foot on the ball and just retained possession, just slow the pace down a little bit and get the other side running. At one point, I remember when we were going into the Copa America, I was hoping that Gio Moreno might be that guy. His career has kind of gone downhill a little bit, and he suffered a bad injury before that competition. But yeah, bringing in, shall we say, sort of a proper 10, I think, has really helped Colombia, and they look extremely strong. So I imagine that there will be a team that nobody will be wanting to face in Brazil next year. Aside from that, I mean, Chile, I think it'll be a stretch too far for Chile, but they're going to be great fun again. I think they're going to win a lot of fans like we did in the previous World Cup. Jorge Sampaoli is now really got them sort of playing the way he wants them to be playing. Obviously, they beat Spain in a friendly, which was a huge result. Had a couple of really good results in qualification and look set to grab their place as well.
You mentioned the off the field kind of issues that Colombia had going into that 94 World Cup, and anybody that's seen the ESPN documentary The Two Escobars mm-hmm. will know have some idea of those issues. Does that still, and I'm asking this purely from a fan's point of view, Rupert, does that still affect Colombian football? Obviously not in the same way, but are there still those outside influences in the game in Colombia?
Nowhere near to that extent. I mean, you remember that was a time when everyone was referring to, throughout South America, was referring to Colombia as Locumbia, you know, crazy Colombia. They had some real social issues there at the time. Obviously, nowhere near as bad as it was then. But I think exactly sort of the way, just the total catastrophe of that tournament really is something that they'll be thinking about. It's something that will be on some of the players' minds. It is something that has been discussed a lot. I mean, football is just a 22 guys kicking a ball around a field without any context. So of course that does come into play, and they know that, you know, this is the highest the expectations have been in the nation since then. So I don't necessarily envisage a collapse like that for them. I think they'll be fine. I think they'll do really well. I think they're one of the dark horses who could probably go quite a long way.
Let's hope so indeed for Colombian football's sake, because it's some fantastic football that they do play. Obviously, the kings of South American qualifier at the moment are Argentina. Already booked their place top of the group as well, of course. And really, for the Argentines, are they now just spending a lot of time with one eye on Lionel Messi and his fitness at this moment in time? Because can Argentina win this World Cup if Lionel Messi does end up having that horrible season that nobody wants to see him have, but everybody's almost kind of been expecting the way he runs himself ragged every single year?
Yeah, well, he never seemed to be injured, did he, for a long time? Just Messi seemed to be playing every single game all the time. Obviously, he's picked up a couple of knocks. He's got one now, obviously, which means he's dropped out of the squad for these games. so, yeah, I mean, an injury problem. I think it's not necessarily just a thing about Argentina. I think if Lionel Messi was playing for any team in the league, well, we've seen it with Barcelona, really, perhaps more so last year than this. But yeah, to lose a player of Messi's pedigree would be a huge problem for any team.
But does it stop them from having a chance of winning it? Without Messi, can Argentina still go in with that same confidence?
Well, no, they certainly can't go in with the same confidence. I think they could still compete. But yeah, I think Messi is sort of that X factor. He is the one that does make them one of the favourites.
What about for Brazil as well? We've discussed a couple of times on the show before the fact that because they are automatically in the World Cup could actually be a big hindrance to them. How have you assessed the way that they've treated these friendly games during international breaks? Do you think that there is a competitive enough mentality as qualification comes to an end from the Brazil side of things, considering they haven't had a competitive game of football since Confederations Cup, and it's been longer than since then, really?
Well, I was concerned. I was certainly concerned for them prior to Luis Felipe Scolari's appointment. But they've, after, I mean, what they had that loss to England at Wembley, but they've really kicked on. Obviously, they had a wonderful, wonderful Confederations Cup tournament, which was really capped off with that victory over Spain, which would have pleased Scolari more than anyone, I think, for a number of reasons. But they've got real, real momentum now. And I think Scolari is, I mean, it's also almost becomes a bit of a cliche when you look back to 2002, but we still talk about the Scolari family, about that wonderful, that real tight-knit group that he brought together, of which, of course, he was the patriarch. And I think that's something he's doing now. If you look at a few of the players just this week since they landed in Seoul, in South Korea, Luis Gustavo was saying how pleased he is that Lucas Leiva's back in the squad, despite him being a competitor for a place. He was saying it's great to have that competition. Oscar was, too has been talking about how about the momentum that Brazil have been building up and how they need to, with these upcoming qualifiers against South Korea and Zambia, they really need to keep that momentum going, keep that winning mentality in the squad. And I think that is something that Scolari's forged, really. And I think for the other guys coming into the squad now, you've got the likes of Alexander Ibato, obviously, will be hoping for a place. Lucas Leiva, of course, will be trying to force a place back in that Brazil squad for good, because, I mean, he's been missing since, what, 2011, I think, now. Mm. Because of injury and just not being selected. But everybody's been talking about not only is it important that the new players coming into the group show what they can do on the pitch, they also need to impress Scolari off the pitch, because a World Cup, a tournament like that, everything happens so quickly, you're playing so many games, you're all together for that amount of time. It really is about the group, more so for Scolari than anybody. And so, yeah, I think with these friendlies now, Brazil just need to keep that momentum going. They need to keep winning. They need to retain that winning mentality. I think Scolari will just be looking for those guys now who can really help with this group.
And the mentality off the pitch, very important for Brazil as well. Of course, in their own back garden, hosting a World Cup, they're going to be the centre of attention next summer. Rupert, thank you so much for taking a bit of time to have a chat with us about South American World Cup qualification. I'd love to get into a little bit more with you, but for the time being, we're going to have to run today. However, we hope we can catch up with you very soon after next Tuesday and talk about how it's all ended up as well, mate.
Of course, I'd be delighted. Thanks, guys. Good fun.
Thank you so much, Rupert, for joining us today. Mr. Rupert Fryer joining us here on World Football Daily, talking all things South American World Cup qualification and getting into the nitty-gritty, if you will, as we get down to these final few games. The big last two games for everybody in World Cup qualification. Those, though, who make the playoffs will have to suffer through two more knockout games, aggregate football. Gotta love it. You just gotta love it. It's getting so important for these South American European. Damn that Europa League making me mix up stuff. For South American, European, Asian, African, and North American football in general. All eyes are on the road to Brazil right now. Chile, Ecuador, Uruguay, all possible to go into that playoff spot. Even Colombia could slide down into that, although highly unlikely indeed if they can get a win against Chile coming up tomorrow night. Ecuador against Uruguay, though, is the big important one. Fourth against fifth, Uruguay, 22 points. Ecuador, 22 points. Goal difference separating these two sides. Uruguay in the playoff spot. Venezuela clinging on for their lives. They are the only one of two teams, sorry, to have played 15 games in that South American group. And they will have to wait and see if Uruguay stumble against Ecuador to see if they have a hope of making it through to the World Cup. They take on Paraguay tomorrow night. 3 points and a Uruguay stumble make it very interesting indeed going into that Uruguay-Argentina game next week. Big thanks there to Rupert Fryer for giving us the update on all things South American football. And you can find Rupert at capital R for Rupert. Not even capital R for Rupert. Rupert underscore Fryer with a capital R and capital F. There we go, man. I'm all over the place today. As you can hear, joining me is Mr. Rafferty. Big thanks as well. Before we move on to Mr. Gonzalez, keeping it very Latino today, actually. What we're talking Mexican football in El Tri with Kim Tate, chatting with South American football with Rupert Fryer, and now bringing on Rafa Gonzalez. I mean, how much more of a Latino show do we want to put out here, Raf, man? I don't know. How you doing today, brother?
Know why. I know there's not a ton of football going on right now, but I'm still very excited to talk to you, Juice. So yeah, it's good to have you back on.
Thank you, brother. I mean, it's always good to be here on WFD. We're obviously talking about Cristiano Ronaldo. I was mentioned yesterday, his perfection, if you will, of Ronaldo. Yes, every game he scores, Madrid never lose. Incredible feat, obviously, for him to have a nice little notch on the belt, if you will. But Josh Graham's got in contact with us about this, emailing the show at worldfootballdaily.com account with a very interesting point of, and Josh says this: do you think that Real Madrid never losing when he scores has anything to do with Ronaldo being so moody? When Ronaldo scores, he's very confident, raises the team's morale, hence winning. That's not Charlie Sheen hashtag winning, by the way. But when things aren't going right, he gets all pouty and emits negative energy towards teammates and the ref. As I say, that's from Josh Graham, premium member of World Football Daily. Raf, does Ronaldo's petulance bring down everything around him in that Real Madrid side and therefore make it impossible for Madrid to grab 3 points if Ronaldo is getting frustrated and negative during a football game? Do you think it's because of his kind of mood swings that we sometimes see in football games that means that Madrid don't have a chance of winning if Ronaldo isn't confident and up scoring goals?
Well, I definitely would agree that Ronaldo tends to influence a team in a massive way. So I would agree that the way Ronaldo goes, so does Real Madrid. So when he does kind of have those times juice where he's not really, all there, he's distracted, he's frustrated, he's upset, he's moody, like you said, that does affect the rest of the team. It distracts them and it disrupts their own play. And when you have such an influential player on the field that you can't really utilize, I mean, that would frustrate just about anybody. You know, nobody wants to play a man down if they're really not, if they have all 11 players on the field. So I would tend to agree with that, man. And I think maybe now with Gareth Bale and generally that step up in competition within the dressing room, maybe that'll even itself out a little bit. But I would have to agree with that. I think I was talking about this with somebody yesterday as well.
It's a very interesting point that Josh does raise about the petulance, because you do see Ronaldo when he gets all grumpy and frustrated, and you do wonder if that does affect the players around him as well. I mean, if you've got your number one superstar who's meant to be not your savior, if you will, but meant to be the guy that you look for to get you out of trouble, who can create those moments of magic and score lucky last minute goals as he did against Levante, it must affect you if you think, wow, our like backup plan, our plan B, which is Ronaldo do something, is really not in this game at all. He's not in the right frame of mind. He's not looking like he's going to fire us out of something. And it does seem that he doesn't have that, when he gets petulant, it doesn't boost him. You know when Rooney gets aggravated in a game and it actually sometimes boosts him, it kicks him on in a game and he raises his game to another level. It doesn't seem to do that with Ronaldo.
Rooney got better. He went into super turbo mode or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, sometimes it leads to him being a hot-headed muppet on the football pitch, but sometimes it can lead to a more invigorated, more rejuvenated, energetic Rooney on the pitch. With Ronaldo, it doesn't seem to do that as much. If the game's going against him and he's getting in that frustrated kind of whiny mode, he never looks like he's suddenly going to burst out with like a frustration and make that mazy run through the pitch or something like that, driven on the adrenaline rush of being so frustrated by the game. It does seem more like it's the other case, which is he just kind of goes, oh, this isn't fair. Yeah. What a game. His little pouty crying
to take
face
his ball and leave. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's a very interesting topic, Josh. Big thanks for getting in contact with us here on WFD to give us your thoughts on Cristiano Ronaldo, that perfect scoring record in La Liga, with obviously every time he scores in La Liga, Real Madrid at least get a point, possibly three. Moving on from Cristiano Ronaldo and yesterday's little chat, we've obviously got the World Cup qualifiers coming up this weekend. And I want to mainly put the groups in Europe into perspective. We've obviously done that with the hexagonal over the last couple of days and South American this Thursday. But we haven't looked too much at the European groups. So I'm going to give you a brief rundown of how each group is standing for World Cup qualification. I'm sure you can find this information elsewhere yourself, but that's what we're going to do for you today, man. We're just going to go through every group and tell you exactly how it's setting up here on WFD.
This is the real opinion, though.
This is the real rundown right here. Group A, World Cup UEFA qualification for Brazil 2014. Belgium on top of the group. We love it. You love it. Haven't lost yet. Looking in control. They require 2 points from their final two remaining games as they take on Croatia away, which is a big one, you have to say. A fall against Croatia away would mean Croatia would only be 2 points off Belgium going into the final round of games. And then they take on Wales at home. Wales without Gareth Bale, though. So surely that means Belgium are going to be getting their way through to the World Cup. They're in prime position. Croatia 5 points behind. Serbia 6 points off them. So Croatia are booked in. Serbia have only got one more game to play.
I like how you probably spent a good 45 seconds to a minute discussing Group A, and not once yet have you brought up the great Macedonians of Macedonia.
In fairness, so I didn't bring up Scotland either. So And you know, we're always rooting for Gordon Strachan on this show. Obviously, a very nice man. He's appeared on we've heard his voice, I'm sure, on WFD back in the past. Obviously a top lad, Gordy Strachan. Mm-hmm. But I'm sorry, but he's not in the running for the World Cup anymore. Neither is Serbia, neither are Macedonia or Wales. So unless they're playing one of the big guys, is it really worth having a chat about them?
I mean, you could always be looking forward to, Euro 2000, 2016, 15?
In France, 2016. Dude, 15? Yeah, yeah. Come on, it's 4 years. It's sorry. Even numbers. Man, World Cups and European Championships, even numbers, baby. Come on, Raph. You know
my
that.
My wife's the math person.
You're better. You're
I
better
never
than
plan
that.
To be math.
You're better than, yeah, but 12 plus 4? Come on. Come on. I tell you what, World Cups are the reason why football fans know their 4x table and their 2x table better than anybody. Because they know it's only 2 years until the European Championships, and they know it's 4 years between World Cups. And if you land it on something like this, where you go 04, 08, 012, 016 on the European Championship front, for instance, you know your 4x table. I mean, kids that were kind of 5 or whatever in the year 2000, they're going to know, especially if they're football fans from Europe, they're going to know their 4x table extremely well, because they'll be thinking, right, it's 4 European Championships from 2000 to 16. So 4x4 is 16. Boom. Football as an educational tool, as well as, of course, the beautiful game for just our pure enjoyment. Moving into Group B, Raph, and getting away from the education. Italy already booked their place. Done, dusted, sorted. Second place, though, wide open between Bulgaria, Denmark, and the Czech Republic as well. Even Armenia can throw their name in the hat with 2 games remaining in this one. Bulgaria with 13 points, Denmark with 12, and the Czech Republic and Armenia on 9 points apiece. So the final games this Friday.
Is there anyone that you would want to personally see make it through?
I like the Czech Republic. You know, really? I'm a big fan of the Czechs. You know, I still love the kind of old side of Ruzicki, Nedved, and Jan Koller. I mean, Jan Koller was a scary-looking guy up front.
He wasn't he?
You would not want to be marking him. Like, towering, bulky, bald centre forward with a ripper of a strike and a powerful head on him as well. You did not want to be stuck marking
him.
You
wouldn't want to meet him in a dark alley, let alone on the pitch.
Yeah, exactly, man. Exactly. And yet you had the flair of Nedved and Ruzicki.
And fantastic in FIFA, by the way. I don't know if people remember that, but Jan Koller was a fantastic forward in FIFA.
I don't think I ever played FIFA when it was.
If you guys ever go back and play a little bit of retro FIFA back in the day, which every now and then, you know what? Like, just a slight distraction here, Juice.
You drop a bit of FIFA 06 every so often or stuff like
that.
Yeah,
you know, I seriously do. Like, I like to pick up sticks for like the old kind of sports games. Like, I was playing NBA 2K2. Okay, like, wow. Oh my goodness. So bad.
Hashtag like, retro ref. What the hell?
Yeah, uber retro. It's like, for me, it's kind of like, you know, owning retro jerseys, you know? It's just,
but
cool.
Owning retro jerseys, the like Mitchell and Ness throwback gear is so much better than owning, owning kind of our video games and stuff.
FIFA 2000. I played that one, man.
What you want is them to bring out these games like all the same stats and stuff like that, but with the updated graphics. That's what you want, you know. Mm. Like you want, for instance, I would take an old school Formula One game with like the modern game engines and stuff like that, but I'd take all the really old school cars from like the 90s. And you have Mansell and Damon Hill and stuff like that. I don't know how big an F1 fan you are, though, Raph. So I won't bore you with any of my F1 fandom here on WFD. Let's get back to the group stages, my man.
Oh, okay.
Let's get back.
Play retro games. That's all.
Who would you want to see then go through? Bulgaria, Denmark, Czech Republic, Armenia? Would you like to see Armenia go through? You know, kind of gutsy side.
Yeah, I guess. Yurav Mavsisian obviously played here in the States. Have a little bit of a connection to him. He's been on our show a couple times. Tried to join us from deepest, darkest Russia once and got cut out, but still. Anyways, I definitely do have a soft spot for the Czech Republic. But I guess I kind of only in name. And because of, you know, their last World Cup appearance, you know, in the States, Bulgaria, I just, you know, there's something that I'd like to see them get through. I've seen Denmark recently. I'm just not really impressed by them. Malta, definitely no. Bulgaria or the Czech Republic, I think, are my two kind of hopes. I guess. Juice. That's about where
I'm at. I do like Denmark as well, I have to say. Although, you know, less of Nicky Bentner, probably the better, I think. Let's move into Group C. Germany, Sweden, Austria still fighting for a bit of survival as well in this, obviously, Republic of Ireland, Kazakhstan, the Faroe Islands, not in the game really anymore. I guess Ireland are, but they're relying on Sweden and Austria to lose both their final games and for Ireland to pick up maximum points as they take on Germany this Friday, and then they are meeting Kazakhstan on Tuesday. Germany 5 points clear at the moment. Sweden can catch them if Germany stumble against Ireland and Sweden then beat them in their final group game coming up on Tuesday. But all that's looking a little unlikely. You'd expect Germany to get past the Faroe Islands. Sweden against Austria is the real game changer. Austria's final game against Sweden, second to last game on Friday. If they beat Sweden and then obviously get their win against the Faroe Islands, and Sweden stumble against Germany in the final group game on Tuesday, then it could see Austria going through. So a little bit of a game changer still left in that one, Raf. We have to keep that one in mind. Netherlands, they're through, but it's the playoff position that everybody's looking at in this one. Hungary, Turkey, Romania, all in the mix. Now, of course, we all remember the great Romania side of kind of 94 from that World Cup, 94 in the US of A. Georgi Hagi, Petrescu, Popescu. I mean, it's a beautiful side that we all remember a fair bit of, and Georgi Hagi producing one of the goals of World Cup history. Turkey, of course, great in the World Cup in 2002. Always kind of been a little overrated in my personal opinion, and I don't think this Turkey side is a patch on the likes of when we had Hasan Sas and Hakan Şükür from back in 2002. Hungary, now this is a very peculiar one indeed, because my real World Cup memory of Hungary is watching a Spain 82 highlights video where I believe Hungary lost 10-1 to I think it was Zbigniew Boniek and the USSR or Poland or someone like that. Not pretty watching if you're a Hungary fan, that's for sure. But Hungary sat in second place, a point ahead of both Turkey and Romania. And going into these final games, you've got Turkey against Estonia, Romania against Andorra, Hungary against Netherlands. Netherlands already through, so you wonder if Hungary have got a chance to pip 3 points off the Netherlands. If they don't, which is the more likely case, opens it up for Turkey, Romania and co. going into Tuesday, with Turkey taking on the Netherlands in their final game next Tuesday, Hungary taking on Andorra, and Romania meeting Estonia.
So I'm sensing you're pulling for Romania in this
one. I kind of want Romania in this one, although I'll take a Hungary. I will take a Hungary. What about yourself, Raf, in Group D?
Hungary, Romania, I'm going to go with Turkey only because we have the Turkish football podcast on World Football Daily.
Oh, fair play. I didn't think of that.
And you seem to think that they're slightly overrated, which is fine. But I'm gonna stick with my Turkey and go with.
I tell you what, I know Andy Brassel, a good friend of the show, likes his Turkish football as well. We were talking about Fatih Terim and Galatasaray and Besiktas the other week here on WFD. Mm-hmm. So I know he's probably pulling for a little bit of Turkey to make their way to the World Cup as well. If that's gonna influence anybody's decisions in who they want to take that final spot, it's like, it's the best of a bad bunch, really, whoever gets through there, isn't it? I don't want to be too horrible, but it is the best of a bad bunch when you get into that group. Moving into Group E, the most open group by a long way. If Switzerland lose their final two games, they can move out of the automatic spot into the World Cup, leaving it open for Iceland, or possibly Slovenia on goal difference, although they'll have to get an 8-goal goal difference over the next two games. But Iceland could take the automatic spot. Slovenia, Norway, and Iceland and Albania all can take the playoff spot, which Iceland currently hold on 13 points, 5 points behind Switzerland in first place, who have 18, Slovenia on 12, Norway on 11, and Albania on 10. With this weekend coming up, Iceland against Cyprus, they take on this lowest ranked side in the group, which could be a very big result for them to pick up 3 points. Albania take on Switzerland, which are the second lowest ranked side in the group. But Albania will be fighting, remember, for that playoff spot, so it's going to be tough for the Swiss on the road. And Slovenia take on Norway. Raf, who do you want going through in this group, bearing in mind that Iceland or Switzerland are going to top it, and then you're going to have Slovenia, Norway, or Albania or Iceland picking up that playoff spot?
Slovenia was... I'm going with Norway, primarily because of the women that they bring to the World Cup.
I do love your reasons for backing some of these countries, man.
Right. Well, and generally, I feel like they're always a good show. A lot of effort, a lot of names that I'm familiar with too, I think. And then also, I don't see, or I don't feel bad for them, you know, when they go. Not that I'd feel bad when Slovenia go, but, or I do feel bad when Norway go, but I'm okay with it. When Slovenia, you know, gets knocked out of a tournament, I don't really feel bad at all. I don't really care. I think it's fine. Norway gets emotionally involved in the tournament.
We've had some great Norway sides. I've been lucky enough to see. I actually went to see Serbia and Montenegro against Norway in the European Championships in 2000, which was pretty cool. Norway, we were sat with the Norway fans. They were a really good laugh as well. Despite having been there, I would like to see a side like Iceland get through. For this is what I'm talking about you want the big sides, but you also want maybe those kind of beautiful football stories to come through, and you're always a bit torn in your mind about what you want. I'm going with Iceland on this one. I'll take Switzerland and Iceland to get through this group. Leave the top two as they are. Let's see what happens. Moving into Group F, Russia, 1 point ahead of Cristiano Ronaldo and Portugal. Russia in a nice position of taking on Luxembourg tomorrow night. The team second from bottom in that group. Portugal meet Israel, and if Israel win their last two games and Portugal stumble in their last two games, then Israel will be going through ahead of Portugal. Portugal, though, take on Luxembourg in their final game on Tuesday. Russia meet Azerbaijan in that final game on Tuesday next week. So Russia, basically, they just need to pick up two wins, which will be ideal, easy for them, will guarantee them top spot. Portugal just need to pick up 2 points from these last two games to guarantee themselves at least a playoff spot, and then it's just a battle between Portugal and Russia. Do we sit with Capello, or do we sit with Ronaldo on World Football Daily of who we want to top this group one, ref? Surely you're going with after how much you lambast and destroy Cristiano Ronaldo on this show, talking about him being so moany and whiny, not being a fan of Los Blancos, you're not suddenly changing your tune as soon as he puts on a Portugal shirt and saying, or is this maybe a bit of old Cold War rivalry still coming through and you don't really want to say kind Russia? Of,
yeah.
Is there a little bit of that?
Even my dog, you know, he's a Siberian Husky, and I've never trusted him fully,
Oh, my goodness. I hope Max can hear you saying that right now.
It's right here.
I hope he's giving you a look of, like, I'm going to bite your leg once this is done, ref. I'm going to bite.
I don't really know. Like, I guess I don't really care who tops it. I just definitely want to see Russia and Portugal make it through.
You want to see both in the tournament, yeah.
Right.
And I guess Portugal gives you a better chance.
Israel could be a really interesting story, and I think that they could be good entertainment in the sense that, you know, there'd be sturdy competitors, and they'd really want it a lot. They'd give it their all. You know, you'd see the emotional kind of play come through. It'd be a really interesting story, I think, but ultimately, I'd rather see Portugal and Russia just make it through. Who tops it? I think if you want both, I prefer Portugal because Nike take care of me.
I guess if you want both through, you want Portugal second because they're more likely, I think, to progress than a Russian side in a possible difficult playoff. But I agree with you on the consensus that we do just want to see both these sides in the World Cup. Moving into Group G, Raf, it stands at the moment with Bosnia and Herzegovina 19 points, Greece 19 points, Slovakia 12 points, Lithuania 8, Latvia 7, Liechtenstein 2. With Greece and Bosnia and Herzegovina both on 19 points, it's obviously looking very good that a point from their next game will see them both guaranteed top spot. Both guaranteed to go through in this group, either to the playoffs or to the guaranteed top spot final tournament position. The decider really does come down to who goes through, though. Greece meet Slovakia tomorrow night with Bosnia and Herzegovina playing against Liechtenstein both away. Liechtenstein bottom of that group, Slovakia third, and will be looking to upset Greece in order to keep their slim hopes alive of getting into a playoff spot. Also, bear in mind that Bosnia have a goal difference of plus 20, Greece just plus 5 in this group. I'm going with Raf. I want Bosnia and Herzegovina straight through into the tournament. I mean, I was lucky enough to watch the game against the USA I was very impressed by Bosnia. They've got a number of players that I'm a big fan of. Obviously, Begovic, Bajanic from Roma, Stefanovic, obviously, and Edin Dzeko and Ibisevic up front. I think two great forwards. And you know how much I love Edin Dzeko, my man. Mm-hmm. So I am going with Bosnia. I want them to top this group. And I will take Greece, obviously, going through. Give him a chance with a playoff, but I'm not fussed whether Greece gets through, my man.
Yeah, to be honest, it's yeah. I'm not even gonna like stop you. Just keep going because I completely agree with you there.
Moving into Group H, probably one of the more difficult groups to call as well at this moment in time. Of course, it's England, Ukraine, Montenegro, Poland, Moldova, and San Marino. We'll be talking with Kristen Hennage a little bit about Gus Poyet and England's chances tomorrow. But with England taking on Montenegro at Wembley and Poland at Wembley on Tuesday, things in theory should be looking good for England to top this group. Ukraine a point behind, Montenegro a point behind England as well in third place, Poland 3 points behind. But Poland beat Ukraine, beat England, they're booking a place in. There's so many possibilities actually. Let's go with two victories will ensure England finish top. Guaranteed, that's fine and dandy. Poland still have a slim chance of finishing in second place, but will have to beat Ukraine and Kiev and England at Wembley. And of course, if England lose to Montenegro, Poland win their two games, then I'm pretty sure that's going to be Poland topping the group. Ukraine obviously still have a great chance going through. They take on Poland coming up tomorrow night. Moldova take on San Marino, which I'm sure, Raf, you've got your DVR set for record for that one. Moldova.
That was the one I was waiting for you to get to.
I was going to say Moldova,
can
San
you
Marino.
Give me a breakdown on that? Like, who's your starting 11 for San Marino?
There's that barber. There's the guy that owns the honey shop. No, these are genuine people. They're like, they have, because obviously they're all semi professional and stuff. So, no, they are like kind of barbers and local men from kind of the San Marino area who always all have their like day jobs and stuff as well. My advice, San Marino players, stick to them. Stick to those day jobs. I don't think the pro career is coming through just yet. You wonder though, maybe with a bit like expert coaching and stuff, how I wonder that would make a fantastic reality TV series, wouldn't it? Going to San Marino.
Just set up the San Marino Academy.
Just getting some coaches in there and seeing how they can kind of improve it. A little bit better kind of facilities and stuff for training. Get some coaches in there and give some of the younger kids maybe coming through the San Marino ranks, you know, 17, 18-year-olds. There's not a big population to choose from, obviously. But, you know, see.
Come 2016.
See if you can improve them.
Yeah, San Marino is looking like a beefed up squad, and their major export is primarily footballers.
That would be something, wouldn't it? I tell you what, I don't want England to go through. I've decided, I've been umming and ahhing over it for so long, but I'm so anti the style of football that England play right now. I really want Poland. I really want Poland to batter them at Wembley, like to tear them apart. We bigged up Poland so much going into the Euros last year, and they're thoroughly disappointed. I want to see Robert Lewandowski firing on all cylinders, just destroy that England back four so that they have to bring in Micah Richards to play. And let's have, I don't mind, it's a toss-up between Ukraine and Montenegro. I don't mind. As long as England don't go through and I don't have to have a World Cup of people going every 5 minutes, let's cut to the England camp and see what they had for breakfast. Do you get that actually during World Cups with the US? Because we always have every show, ITV and BBC, they will always cut to. And here's what Roy Hodgson had to say today about what the steaks were like at lunch and all these kind of complete bull discussions that, you know, really do. And it's always cameras following England around and stuff. And I know it's obviously your home country, you're meant to be. But I want to get to know about other teams and other national teams and stuff like that, not just focus on England 24/7. The sooner they're out of the tournament, the better, in my idea. Do you get that? Is it like, and now we're going to cut over to Jurgen Klinsmann? And Klinsmann, we chatted with you yesterday about what you thought of other teams. What do you think of these teams? Like, is it that kind of thing as well on ESPN and stuff?
How is just, we got the, and look, it's the Americans on safari.
Oh, right, yeah.
You know what I mean?
When they do their odd day trip about.
Following them through the South African safari grasslands and stuff. And, oh, man, look at this. Like, look, we're tweeting out pictures of giraffes. And
oh my God, man, we don't have them. Those rhinos in Texas. I want to hunt that.
Yeah. That we only got armadillos, man.
Yeah. Man, that makes some crazy ass roadkill, that. Yeah. No, why am I making it sound like the U.S. men's national team is a bunch of like Southern Hicks?
A bunch of Texans.
And I apologize. I apologize.
Southerns. No, that's not the case. I know a lot of them. I hope they know we're not making fun of them. please.
please know that we're not making fun of
them. Please know.
But I
do get tired of that. And I mean, I don't know. I greatly appreciate the actual game coverage that they give, and that's really what I'm watching. So as long as they keep the game, the game coverage, the game cameras, the picture just crystal clear like they do, I've got no complaints, and they can put whatever other filler they want in front of me, and I will eat it up while it's there because I'm just enthralled by the World Cup. So just keep the game nice, crisp, clean. I'm okay.
Let's get into the final group before we get stuck down with already the disappointment that World Cups can be on occasions. Final group, reigning world champions, of course, Spain and France, Finland, Georgia, and Belarus. Now, with France and Finland having played 7 games, obviously only 8 games to be played in this group by each team, it does mean that we're in a little bit of a peculiar situation that we know that France and Spain are going to be going to the World Cup or the playoff tournament. What we don't know is who's going to be going there as the group winner and who's going to have to make their way through those disastrous playoffs once again. Spain on 14 points, France on 14 points too, but Spain have that game in hand, which is being played tomorrow as they take on Belarus. If they get 3 points, it's game, set, match. They'll need a point against Georgia to guarantee it. Obviously, goal difference will come into it as well. If they only get a point, it leaves the door open for Spain to stumble against Georgia and France to beat Finland. Finland, though, a tough side, you have to say. They've not been terrible throughout this group. It's been a very enjoyable side to watch. But my money's on Spain topping it, obviously, with Belarus and Georgia. You expect 6 points from that. They'll finish with 20 points. France will finish with 17. That's going to be the order of this group. Raf, do you see a stumble from Spain in any way, shape, or form?
No, sir, I do not. And it's not even worth kind of discussing. I think it's pretty straightforward. Spain have more on their third-string squad to top Belarus and Georgia 3 times over. it should be Spain, France going through, and I'm beyond okay with seeing that happen.
It's pretty much all set then. The World Cup is almost sorted out. We will know by next week.
When can we get our charts, Juice? That's what I'm asking. Like, when do the official World Cup charts start coming out?
You've got to wait for the World Cup preview magazines and stuff like that, and the draw, which will be December 6th, of course, down in Brazil.
Oh, I'm so excited, Juice.
That's when you kind of sat on the edge of your sofa thinking, all right, who have we got then? If England have to be in it, who have they got? Please be Brazil. Please be Brazil.
I mean, again, since US have pretty much booked our tickets, I'm salivating over the whole.
Do you find yourself eyeing up the competition now for these World Cup qualifiers? Is that what more that you're going to be doing rather than focusing on maybe the CONCACAF games? Are you going to be flittering about a bit, seeing what the competition's got? Maybe checking out the Switzerland game to see if they get through. You know, are they going to be a test with Shaqiri and Co in that Swiss side, or are you going to be sticking to kind of CONCACAF?
No. I'm definitely looking ahead at this point, Juice. I'm not going to lie to you, man. That's why I was saying, you know, like, just give me your top 2 in the group because I want to. I need to know.
You want to start your research early.
Yeah. And to be honest, man, Switzerland. That'd be a really tricky side for us. I think really tricky.
You reckon what the pace? Yeah. A little bit of speed in that side.
Here's why. Purely because we dumbass Americans look at the Swiss. What? The only thing they got is like banking and the Swiss Army knife. Like, come on, man. Like, we got, you know, we're so kind of like short-minded like this that's what we think.
Aren't they like two of the they almost represent though two very significant things for a country, don't they? You know, yeah. Military and money, Swiss banking, yeah. Swiss army knife. I mean, I'd be fearful of a country that's main things it's famous for are for the military, knives and for having a lot of money. I mean,
but of course, we see ourselves as the ultimate military power juice. So, I mean, who
that's
is
true,
the
that's
Swiss?
True. And I suppose an M16 isn't going to do a lot. It's going to do a lot more damage than a penknife, isn't it? I suppose.
Than a screwdriver.
In a battle like that, yeah. Well, I've got a toenail clipper. Yeah, nice try, mate.
A mini handsaw. Yeah.
I've got a mini hand grenade. There you go, son. let's get away from the now imminent destruction.
Seriously, that's why the Swiss would be a tricky side for the U.S. because we take it too short-minded and would think, well, it's just the Swiss. Like, we can beat these guys. Like, this is, you know, they wouldn't take it as seriously as they would in Italy, where they, you know, they really raise their game level to a maximum, competition. And then all of a sudden, they can beat Italy every now and then. The Swiss is a side that they can easily stumble upon and kind of not or lose focus on.
Possibly. It'd be very interesting to see. We have.
I'm already at the World Cup discussing my matchup between. If the United States end up drawing Switzerland, Jews, we're fucked. I mean, I'm sorry. I'll excuse my language, but I mean, you just jinxed me. I think because I'm talking so far ahead.
Rein yourself back in. Let's get into the present. One last thing I want to ask you about, and I meant to ask you about it yesterday. Do you find Jack Wilsh has been saying about, and I stand corrected on the quote, it wasn't about born in England, but English players playing for England, and obviously not wanting liking the idea of genocide to play for England. The US men's national team has had this kind of thing going on within its ranks before. Mm-hmm. Do you find it kind of detracts slightly if you've got a number of players in the US men's national team that aren't really people who you would consider, I don't want to say full-fledged Americans because that does sound really xenophobic, like, oh, you can't be here.
No,
but you know what I mean? Maybe not born or have lived the majority of their lives in a different country and then playing for the US men's national team was through kind of loose ancestry or something like that. I mean, does that detract anyway at all from how you perceive it?
For me, it kind of does. I'm not going to lie. It's hard for me to connect with, what is it, Jermaine Jones, who didn't really speak, English very well. And, it didn't really grow up here in the States. Like you want to look at your team and connect with them. And I think that, when I look at Landon Donovan and the fact that he grew up in Southern California and, you know, there's a lot of things that I can kind of connect with him. When he says, oh, I surf all the time. Great. I've surfed before in California. You know, like, that's, yeah. These are personal connections that I have with these guys. It's also the reason why I got really upset with Sasha Kleischen, because the first time I ever got to interview him, I asked him, man, you're from Huntington Beach. Like, what's your favorite surf break? He's like, "Surf? What? I don't surf." And I was like,
"Oh."
I hate you, but not really. I don't hate you, Sasha. I was just messing, but it did break my heart a little bit. But like Maurice Adu, it's why I personally have a huge, connection with this guy. He's from Southern California. We've met all over the world. I've literally met him in Glasgow, Scotland. I've met him, in Sandy, Utah, and, in San Diego, California. I've met him all over the place. Phoenix, Arizona. Anyways, like these are, they go to places that I go to when they go to McDonald's, I know, hey, I know what it's like to go to McDonald's in the States. I know what it's like to go shopping for, new Nikes or new basketball kicks, get your American style on. When I see them take pictures of themselves in their new, gear or something like that, or at Roscoe's Chicken and Waffles or something, I'm just throwing things out there. Like when they do things that are American, I connect with that. And it's definitely something that I know. And when they do, bio pieces and stuff online,
but I guarantee if he scores a winner in a World Cup quarterfinal, there'll be no problems, right?
Absolutely not. No, no. He's American as apple pie.
Exactly. Exactly. See, that's what I love. How whatever happens on the pitch will immediately change people's kind of opinion in that moment.
I mean, it is something that kind of. you know, I mean, I wonder, okay, how about this? I wonder how many people kind of instantaneously gravitate to them as a hero of the national side. You know what I mean? Like, they almost have to prove themselves worthy or you know, on a different level or something like that, you know? You know, it's easy for us to get behind a Brian McBride as Captain America, you know? Like, he looked American, he acted American, he had that American spirit. Like, it was so easy for people to just gravitate towards him and see him as a leader of our team, and as a hero of our team, really. Same with Donovan. Like, there's just a lot of things about these players that you just gravitate towards because they are Americans, and there's a lot of things that they do that I guess kind of come off that way. And when you don't know some of the players that are, you know, are coming into your national squad and where they've played from, or you know where they've been playing, who they're playing for, how they're technically American, you know, or how they're technically your national team player. It is distracting. I'm not saying it's necessarily a bad thing. It does
make a difference in how you perceive it. And I think that's what Arsene Wenger's been talking about as well. Talking about, you know, and you'll get to a point where kind of countries are buying passports and this sort of thing. And you don't want to see it turn into a transfer market like we have on the club football level as well. And it can never be like that. But you know what I mean? There's always a way around things to ensure maybe that a player can represent a different nationality on occasion. We will leave it at that for today here on WFD. Cracking show. Big thanks to both our guests for joining us today on World Football Daily. Big thanks to you, Raf, as well. Remember to keep those hashtag Project Pink tweets coming in. Not only will you be raising money for breast cancer awareness, but you will also be putting your name in the boot, so to speak, for that Gael Clichy, signed Gael Clichy Puma Evo Speed boot. Remember to keep them coming in here on the show. Keep emailing us, show at worldfootballdaily.com, at WFootballDaily on Twitter, 310-909-8483, and the Facebook page as well. This has been Thursday's edition. The World Cup qualifiers are tomorrow. You Yankees are so lucky you get to relax. I'm relaxed too, because I'm not even bothered if we can get there. We'll talk about it tomorrow on the show with our guests. We'll see you then. Have a good one. Oh, Sweden, England, we love you. The pride of English countryside. Oh, Sweden, England, we love you.